solve large, intractable problems.
It's a new venture altogether.
Your brain is a wild horse there.
Because remember, writing is not a team sport.
You are not selling horse carriages when there are cars.
I want to be known only as a trusted advisor.
More like a tourist.
Play to Potential Podcast.
Just like you would say, where does this new painting go in our home? You consider options and you pick one. And if it doesn't work there, then you try another one. And that's a big part of the Tiny Habits method, is you design the new habit. And if it doesn't work, you redesign it. You don't beat yourself up. You don't cause yourself to feel bad, because it's not a willpower or a discipline issue. It's a design issue. Just like putting a new painting on a wall where it doesn't work well, that's not a discipline or a willpower flaw. That's a design issue. So first of all, you get better and better at how to design things in your life.
Welcome to the 58th conversation at the Play to Potential podcast. I'm your host, Deepak Jayaraman, and I work with leaders as a leadership coach, sounding board, or as a transition advisor as they navigate their journeys. In this podcast series, we feature conversations from leaders from different walks of life around the world on three primary themes: leadership, transitions, and careers. My guest this time is BJ Fogg. He's the head of the Behavior Design Lab at Stanford University and the author of the recently published book Tiny Habits. He's been spending several years understanding human behavior and how we can think about building sustainable habits. During the conversation, he breaks down the foundations of a new habit into three elements: motivation, ability, and prompt, and speaks about how we can work on each of these to bake in new habits. He also talks about the nuance in how we untangle ourselves from bad habits. He insists that untangling is a better metaphor than breaking a bad habit. I think you'll find this really valuable. I learned a lot from this conversation. Without further ado, let's dive into the conversation with BJ Fogg. BJ, thank you so much for making time for the Play to Potential podcast. Excited to have you here.
Deepak, thank you for inviting me.
And before we dive into your talking about your work on tiny habits, I'm curious about people's journeys and how they end up doing what they do. You started your career looking at persuasive technology, and now you've sort of gravitated to studying behavior design. So talk to us a little bit about how you got here and what's been your curve of curiosity over time.
Yeah, well, I would rewind really to my childhood, because it helps show why I was interested in behavior and behavior change and helping people. I grew up in California in a Mormon home. My parents and grandparents and great-grandparents, all of them were Mormons. And part of the Mormon tradition, part of the Mormon culture, is you don't drink coffee, you don't smoke, you don't drink, you pray twice a day, you fast once a month. And there's a whole bunch of behavior restrictions. And a lot of the culture, I mean, Stephen Covey comes also from this culture, and the Marriotts and Mitt Romney and things like that. So there is a culture around optimizing yourself. And so I certainly grew up with that sense and with focus on regulating your behavior and optimizing your behavior. And so that was just a natural thing for me to think about habits and self-optimization and so on. And then I did I did too much schooling at universities, and it included work in rhetoric, where I was really fascinated with the power of language to influence and persuade. And that led me to technical writing and technical communication, which really focused me on the importance of simplicity. And then I went to Stanford and became a social scientist, a behavior scientist, shifted gears entirely. But I was still very interested in how human behavior gets influenced, and especially the power of simplicity. So like you said, I did early work, and I called it persuasive technology, doing research on how computers could influence our attitudes and behaviors way before they were doing that. I was mapping out the potential and showing the good things to do, but also the dangers and the bad things. And then became much more interested in health habits around 2009 and not interested really in technology. So then my work became more focused. So I was running a research lab at Stanford, the lab I still run. And really we shifted and to a domain that now we call behavior design. And that's all about new models of understanding behavior, new methods for designing behaviors. And one of those methods is tiny habits. But tiny habits is one of a larger set of models and methods that I call behavior design.
Got it. And maybe just to lay out the landscape, BJ, what else would you put in there in the realm of behavior design?
Well, the FOG behavior model, which is the fundamental model of how all behaviors work. Mm-hmm. And it's a function of motivation, ability, and prompt. So that's really the model that made everything much, much clearer to me and helped mm-hmm. me set aside so much of the traditional stuff, both in academics and just in popular culture about behavior and behavior change that is either wrong or not effective. And so with the behavior model, it's like, no, this is how behavior actually works. Everything boils down to these three components. And then on the method side, there's a set of methods that some have funny names like crispification and focus mapping and snap testing. And the methods are about designing for behavior change, where the models are ways of understanding or interpreting behavior. And in behavior design, the models and the methods work together.
Got it. And maybe just to dive in to your work, BJ, I read your book, Tiny Habits, with a lot of interest. And in the book, you talk about the Maui habit as soon as we wake up. Mm-hmm. And I think it's worth talking about it since you're sort of, I understand you're doing this podcast from Maui as we speak.
I'm in Maui. Yes.
You're in Maui. Lovely. So maybe it's a good place to start. Talk to us about what it is and why it makes such a big difference to our lives.
Yeah. In the book, Tiny Habits, there's only one habit I prescribe for everybody. The rest of the book is how to create any habit that you want. But early on, I say, start doing this one habit. And it goes like this. After your feet touch the floor in the morning, as you're getting out of bed, say, it's going to be a great day. Say those seven words. And I prescribe that habit for everybody because I have so much feedback over the years of teaching tiny habits and advocating for that particular habit that it made me very confident that every reader of the book would benefit from saying it's going to be a great day as you get out of bed. And so it's especially funny when I'm here in Maui doing it. I get out of bed and I look out the window and there's the ocean and sometimes the moon. So I get up kind of early. Sometimes the moon is just over the ocean and it's really easy to say it's going to be a great day. And in other contexts, let's say I'm traveling and I'm tired and I'm in some hotel room and I'm really wondering why I'm there. I still say it, even if I don't believe it's going to be a great day, I say it's going to be a great day somehow. Mm-hmm. And that opens the door, opens the possibility to having a great day. And so it's just seven words. And some people change it up and say, it's going to be an awesome day. Some people change the timing. You know, as they're brushing their teeth in the morning, they say it. That's fine. But the key seems to be that by stating that intention, your brain actually entertains the possibility it could be a great day. And if you're waking up in a great spot and you think it will be, it helps you optimize for making it a great day.
Got it. And you also in the book, before we get into the three pieces you spoke about, motivation, ability, and prompt, you also talk about the ABC of tiny habits,
yeah.
Anchor, behavior, and celebration. And I was curious about, you know, the three, but more specifically celebration. But I'd love to hear from you on how you see the three and why each of these elements are required for us to sow a habit seed in our lives.
Yeah. So the tiny habits method was derived from my behavior model. So, and we'll probably get to this, but, you know, motivation, ability, and prompt, the core components are embedded in the method itself. And so the ABC of tiny habits is kind of an accident that it's ABC. That was not intentional. It just happened. Mm-hmm. But A stands for the anchor. So that's the thing you already do. It's solid and reliable in your life. The anchor then reminds you to do the new habit. So the B is the behavior. What's the tiny behavior? So brushing, might be your anchor. You always brush. And let's say you don't have the habit of flossing. So flossing is what then comes right after brushing. So brushing becomes the reminder to floss. And that's how you do it in the tiny habits method. You don't put up post-its. You don't use alarms. You use an existing routine. In tiny habits, we call it an anchor, to be the reminder for the new habit. And you don't make the habit big. You make it super tiny. So if you want to floss, perhaps it's just floss one tooth. If you want to meditate, maybe it's just three breaths. So you just scale it back so it's so tiny. And the C part stands for celebration. And that is a technique to cause a positive emotion inside yourself, an instant positive emotion. And it's that emotion that wires the habit in. So if I'm flossing one tooth, and if I go, way to go, BJ, I look in the mirror and I smile at myself, and I feel a positive emotion, what I'm doing with that emotion, with that hack, like, way to go, BJ, I am wiring that habit into my brain. So it's a new technique. It's a new way of looking at habits. It's really effective if you can find the authentic celebration, and you can wire in habits very quickly by doing it. So it's not about repetition. It's about the emotion that you feel while you're doing the new behavior. That's what causes, if it's a positive emotion, that's what causes the habit to form.
And I like the word authentic celebration. Could you sort of double click on the word authentic and how that plays up in the way we think about celebration?
Triple click. It's so important. It's so important. You know, this morning I was teaching Tiny Habits at 5 a.m. And one of the celebrations that was natural for somebody was, you know, hands over their head, like victory. Like, yeah, like you would see a runner crossing the marathon finish line. That for a lot of people is a natural celebration that helps them feel like, yeah, I succeeded. But for some people, it's going to make them feel foolish. So if doing that makes you feel foolish or awkward or silly, it's not going to work. So you got to find what works for you. And there's a few simple exercises you can do for this. So let's say you're watching a game of cricket and your team is behind. And at the last moment, your team wins. What do you do? As you see your team win, whatever your natural reaction is, that could be a great celebration for tiny habits. You just bring that in and you do it after you floss. Or think about when you get your exam back and you got a perfect score and you're alone, right? You're not in the class. You're alone and you get it. What do you do? Let's say, for example, you are throwing a piece of paper into the trash bin across the room and you're not sure you're going to make it, but you throw it and it goes in. What do you do at that moment? Those are all clues of what your natural celebration would be. So you take those clues and then you actually apply it deliberately. So you don't leave that emotion to chance in tiny habits. You deliberately, you hack that emotion in order to change what's going on chemically in the brain. And it has to do with dopamine regulation. And that's what rewires the brain.
Got it. I love the fact that you picked cricket for the analogy.
Ba-doom. Surprisingly enough, in fourth grade in Fresno, California, we learned to play cricket, which was really, really odd. But we did a lot of odd things when I was a kid.
Wow, that's fascinating. Let's talk about the three pieces of the puzzle: motivation, ability, and prompt. And let's start with prompts. You call prompts the maybe actually just to pause even before we dive in. You know, you talk about, you know, the way, I mean, to phrase it using finance terms, the motivation ability indifference curve, if I may call it that, you know, the way the curve, could you sort of maybe visually paint the picture for us on how that curve plays out? And then we can dive into it.
Yeah. Oh, I am a kind of teacher that loves a whiteboard. So, but it basically works like this. So in the behavior model, you have motivation, ability, and prompt. So let's talk about just motivation and ability. Those two components work like teammates. And if the motivation is really high for a behavior, you can do hard behaviors. But if the motivation's really low, you can't do hard behaviors. Therefore, it has to be really easy. Or in other words, you have to have high ability to do the behavior. So one of the breakthroughs in that model is the understanding that motivation ability can compensate for each other. So it's a compensatory relationship, and talking about them as teammates is a little more straightforward. Let's say you're playing volleyball and there's two people on a team. If your teammate's really strong, you can be weak and you can still win. You both can be strong, but you both can't be weak. Otherwise, you won't win. So if motivation's low and it's hard to do, then despite how many times you're prompted, you won't do the behavior. So there is a curve that I call the action line on a landscape, that the visual version of the model. And if you're above that line, so if motivation is high and ability is high enough, you're above the line, you will do the behavior when prompted. If either one is zero, if you have no motivation or you have no ability, then of course you won't do the behavior when prompted. And if they're both relatively low, you're probably below the action line. And even when prompted, you don't do the behavior. So what's really exciting, I think, I mean, it looks so simple graphically, but the implications are enormous. It helps you understand that in order to do hard things, you have to have high motivation. But then when you look at the reality of being a human being, you don't always have high motivation. So that means to be consistent in doing any behavior, it needs to be easy to do. And this was the insight that led to Tiny Habits. If the habit, the new habit, is really easy to do, then you don't need high levels of motivation. Your motivation can sag and it can be pretty low, and you'll still do the behavior when prompted. So that's that Tiny Habits method came from me looking at my own model and seeing that, you know, acknowledging that motivation goes up and down over time. We don't have lots of control over levels of motivation, but we can make things easier to do. In fact, let's make them so easy to do that the motivation needed is minuscule. And that's really what Tiny Habits is about. It's about consistency of doing the habit, not the size or the difficulty of the habit.
Got it.
This is your host, Deepak Jayaraman here. This piece reminds me of my conversation with James Clear, the author of Atomic Habits, who was earlier on the podcast. He makes the link between sowing a new habit and small changes in our identity as a result.
Every action you take is like a vote for the type of person you want to become. And so, in a sense, your habits are how you embody a particular identity. Like every time that you make your bed, you embody the identity of someone who's clean and organized. Every time that you make a healthy meal and cook that at home rather than eating out, you embody the identity of someone who is focused on eating healthy. Every time that you write one sentence, you embody the identity of a writer. And no, those little actions, those tiny habits, do not radically transform your body overnight. They don't lead to a written book in a single day, but they do cast a vote for being that kind of person. And so early on, that's really powerful because those habits provide evidence of this new identity. They give you a reason to root that belief in something.
James basically talks about how the small habit, whether you call it atomic habits or tiny habits, starts moving the needle with how we think about ourselves, and how that slowly starts turning into a slow but steadily evolving virtuous cycle. For more, do look up my conversation with James Clear. Now, let's get back to the conversation with BJ Fogg.
And to maybe bring the third variable in, prompts. And you call prompts the low-hanging, you call it the low-hanging fruit of behavioral change. Why so?
Oh, because it's just, we can design prompts in and out of our life pretty easily. So a prompt is anything that reminds you or cues you or triggers you to do a behavior. I'm using all of those as synonyms. It's the thing that says, do this now. Mm-hmm. And there are various sources. There's basically three categories of prompts. And in Tiny Habits, the category we use is you use your existing routine to be the prompt. And that's different, and that's a breakthrough. And that means you don't use the other category, what I call context prompts, which is post-its, alarms, other people, notifications, all those things that annoy us. You don't use that in the Tiny Habits method. Instead, you use something that's natural, something that's already built into your life, an existing routine And then you anchor your new habit to that existing routine. And so it's, and that insight didn't come to me for a while later. So I knew motivation, ability, how they work together. And I knew that making something super simple would let you be consistent in creating a habit. But then it's like, how do you prompt it? How do you prompt it? And then that just happened, like a lot of breakthroughs. You know, there's literally was getting out of the shower and it's like, oh my gosh, it's after. You figure out what this comes after and you use the preceding behavior to remind you of the next thing, this new habit that you want. And so then it was, then it all clicked. And then I knew I had all the pieces in place because it always comes back to just motivation, ability, prompt. And then I knew I had, here's this breakthrough way of habits where you're hacking three things. One, you're making the behavior super tiny, so you don't need much motivation. Two, you are prompting it through something you already do, an existing routine that we call an anchor in Tiny Habits. And then three, you manipulate your emotion so your brain takes notice and goes, whoa, that feels good. I want to do that again in the future. And so you don't leave that to chance. You deliberately celebrate and cause that emotion to fire off, which then changes the regulation of dopamine in the brain.
Got it. And if maybe you talk about the, you know, brushing and flossing analogy, right? And if I apply it to my life, you know, I often say, tell myself that, yes, after I brush, I should floss and maybe start with one tooth. But sometimes my memory fails me and I just sort of move on to something else. Mm-hmm. Even if we stick with that notion of attaching a tiny habit on the back of an action that we already do, how do we remind ourselves to do the tiny habit? Is there some nuance there in the way we make that connection?
Yeah, there's all of this is a system. In fact, that's the I think what I'm proudest about the book Tiny Habits is like, hey, everybody, there's a system behind human behavior. It's not guesswork. There's a way to systematically understand it, systematically design for it, and so on. And it's simpler than you think. So let me touch two parts of the system of how to get an effective anchor that will remind you to do the habit. First, from the beginning, as you're designing the tiny habit, what's called the recipe. It's like, okay, how do you make it super tiny? A floss one tooth. What does it come after? And so as you, this is a design challenge, not a willpower challenge. So you look around and say, well, what does flossing naturally come after in my life? And for pretty much everybody, it's after you brush. Now, for other types of habits, it may not be so obvious. Let's say somebody wants a meditation habit and they scale it back to just three breaths. And they go, okay, when does taking three meditative breaths, or at least calming breaths, where does that fit? What does it come after? And so they have to do some a bit of design and maybe a bit of exploration. And it probably doesn't come after you turn on the TV. That's not going to, after I turn on the TV, I'll take three calming breaths. Nah, not the right place. It might be after you empty your spam folder, after you sit down at work. It could be after you start the coffee maker. So you design, just like you would say, where does this new painting go in our home? You consider options and you pick one. And if it doesn't work there, then you try another one. And that's a big part of the Tiny Habits method is you design the new habit. And if it doesn't work, you redesign it. You don't beat yourself up. You don't cause yourself to feel bad because it's not a willpower or a discipline issue. It's a design issue. Just like putting a new painting on a wall where it doesn't work well, that's not a discipline or a willpower flaw. That's a design issue. So first of all, you get better and better at how to design things into your life. Then if it's really not sticking, like you're really not remembering to do the flossing, then there's a technique that this, I'm just warning everybody listening, you're going to think this is crazy at first, but you rehearse the sequence of behaviors with a celebration. In other words, you accelerate habit formation by drilling over and over. And I don't mean like 100 times. I'm talking 7 to 10 times where you would pretend like you're done brushing. You'd set your brush down. You'd pick up the floss. You'd floss one tooth and go, good for me, and smile in the mirror or whatever your celebration is. And then you would do it again immediately. Pretend like you're brushing, put your brush down, pick up your floss, celebrate. And drill that sequence with a celebration and do that 7 to 10 times. Now, I know people are going to think I'm crazy for suggesting this. However, if you understand that habit formation is a skill, and the way you nail habits is the same way you nail other skills, where you, like, if you want to be great at golf, you practice putting. If you want to be great at tennis, you do serves over and over. Basketball, you practice the 3-point shots over and over. Same thing with habits. You can actually drill and practice. But in this case, you also celebrate. So you're accelerating the speed of habit formation. Now, that's what you do if it doesn't wire in naturally. There's some habits you design and bam, they just click. Just they're done, one and done. But the ones that just don't seem to be sticking and you don't want to redesign it, then you go to this drill. Now, I think in the future, this might be 10 years from now, it will be common practice that you do this from the beginning. Any new habit you want, great. Walk through the behavior sequences, do the anchor, do the new tiny behavior and celebrate and do it over and over. And I'm going to predict that's going to just be standard practice at some point in the future. And that's what you do at the beginning to wire in a habit, not as, end of your rope troubleshooting technique.
Got it. And talking about prompts, BJ, you also talk about the fact that in the long run, action prompts will matter more and more than context prompts. And you speak about the implications for business here. And I found that quite nuanced. Could you talk about that for a couple of minutes?
Yeah, really important. So most of the book, Tiny Habits, can help business people who are creating habits in others or themselves or creating products and programs, even though the book is written for everyday people to change behaviors in their own life. I do a lot of work, and I have for 20 years, working with businesses and startups and helping them be effective. And I couldn't add the full business approach in the book because it would have been too long. And my editor thought it would confuse people. But what's there, you can apply to business. And I do talk a little bit about this issue, and let me explain it. So action prompts, that is the category like the anchors, where you're being prompted by something that happens naturally, whether it's your own routine, whether it's a baby crying, whether it's a stoplight changing, or your kid coming home from school and saying, hey, dad, I'm home. Like any of those can serve to be a reminder to do a new behavior. Like your kid coming home saying, hey, dad, I'm home, might be the prompt for you to go give your kid a hug. Now, those kinds of prompts are all around us. We already have lots of those. And they're not annoying. Because they already happened to us. All we have to do is build an association between your kid saying, hey, dad, I'm home, and the habit, as opposed to the context prompts. Those are the post-its, the email reminder, the pop-ups, the notifications on your phone. We are overwhelmed with those. And those are getting less and less effective, and people are just becoming blind and deaf to those because there's so many of them and we can turn some of them off. So the thing I'm trying to help business leaders understand is that your investment in context prompts, in trying to put something in front of somebody, whether it's an email or a sponsored post, those are things that are going to get less and less effective because there's more of those and we're tuning them out. So if you need to help your customers create a habit, find where it fits naturally in their routine and tell them. Let me give an example. LinkedIn. Yay, LinkedIn. So I, for probably most of 20 years, I've had no use for LinkedIn because I'm not looking for a job and I'm not looking to hire people. But with my book out and my aspiration of helping as many people as I can with my book, it's like, okay, I need to get back with the program on LinkedIn. Yeah, my profile's embarrassing and it's out of date. And I've got over 1,000 people I've not linked to. but I need to make this a habit. Now, and so I found what it comes after for me. And it's basically after I read The Guardian. So I read The Guardian every morning to get an outside perspective a little bit. Then I go and I just look at my LinkedIn feed. That's where it fits. Now, if I were a LinkedIn product manager, if I was trying to get more people to use LinkedIn who had stopped using it, I could just do a tiny bit of research and say, when do people use LinkedIn on a daily basis? Where have people found that this fits naturally in their life? Oh, we did some research and we found that after people check the news, then they check LinkedIn. And then we found for other people, after they sit down on the bus or the train, then they check LinkedIn. And we found for other people, it's as soon as they sit down for their lunch break, that's when they check LinkedIn. So they could take those insights and they could feed that back to people like me who had lapsed on LinkedIn and said, hey, using LinkedIn daily is a great way to keep up with important things in your industry. And try one of the three spots after you finish reading the news. After you read the news, then fire up LinkedIn. Or after you sit down on the bus or train, then fire up LinkedIn and so on. So you could tell your customers, this is where, here's some possibilities where it fits in your life. Try it out and see what works for you. So then they don't have to send me notifications or emails or just lose me as a customer. They tell me how to design the LinkedIn habit into my life.
I like that. I mean, maybe back to your metaphor of hanging a painting, maybe proactively work with you to figure out where to hang that painting in your house.
Yeah, right. And with a little bit of research, they could probably discover, I'm going to make a guess here, that there are, I'll just stick with three places, that there are 50% of their daily active users probably position it, 50% is too optimistic, 25%, with just three suggestions that could cover 25% of their daily active users. And then probably 10 spots, 10 routines, probably cover 50%. So it's not like there's 100 spots it fits. There's a finite number. Well, there's a finite for most people. And they could just discover that and then just help their customers create the habit. So I think that's the future for most businesses that need to create habits, rather than using annoying reminders and emails and whatever, is you help your customers or potential customers, you help those people design it into their life. So don't let them just guess. Tell them where it goes. Just like if I were to buy a painting and somebody says, guess what? This painting needs to go on a big wall and it needs to be, you know, facing away from or having natural light. Then you've guided me where to put that painting and I won't make a mistake of putting on a tiny wall in the dark.
Got it. Got it. Let's move to the other piece, BJ, ability. You talk about the ability chain. And yeah. Urges to explore the weak links in the chain. Talk to us about what the ability chain is in the context of behavioral change.
Yeah, one of the most important things to do for any type of behavior, habits especially, but there's other types of behavior like doing a behavior once or doing it for a limited period of time, is to make it easy to do. And in tiny habits, you make it radically easy. And when you look at what comprises ability, what makes something easier or hard to do, it boils down to five different things. And the chain model is a good model for it because it's the weak link that makes it hard. So I'll give the five links in the chain. One is, how much time does this take? So if it takes a lot of time and you don't have a lot of time, then that's a weak link. How much money does it take? Well, it takes a lot of money and you don't have much money, then that can be a weak link. How much thinking does it take? How much physical effort? And the last one is, how well does it fit into your routine? So it could be that all of those links are strong, except let's pick the money one. Like, it takes very little time, very little thinking, very little effort. It fits beautifully into your routine, but it costs, let's say, $199 a month. Well, that's a weak link that makes that behavior hard for you to do. So when you're designing habits into your life, you want to look at a habit and say, what's making this hard to do? And can I make that easier? If you're designing for customers, for example, and they're not doing the behavior, even though they're motivated, then it's like, well, it's too hard to do. What's making it hard? Is it we're asking for too much time, too much money? have we made it too complicated so they have to think and so on? And then you shore up the weakest link in order to make it easier to do.
Got it. And you also talk about people getting caught up in burst or bust cycles. And I found that phrase quite interesting. And you urge us to climb the little habit hills from where we could build our habits. So talk to us about, again, the nuance around this approach and why it makes sense.
So yeah, when we talk about motivation, everyone has a common sense notion of what motivation is. And for the most part, that's accurate. The academic work on motivation is actually quite confusing and not as clear as you would think it would be. And one of the areas where the history of academic work and motivation really fails or hasn't happened is when it looks at how motivation shifts over time. I mean, it's a pretty ordinary experience to understand, at least in the US, at least in the culture I'm in, in December, it's Christmas time and people get excited about connecting with family and buying presents. So motivation goes up to connect with family and to buy gifts. But December 26, boom, motivation goes down. Valentine's Day, people get excited about relationships, at least in the US. Tax deadline is April 15th. Boom, motivation goes up to do taxes. So these swings in motivation we've all experienced, but it never had been named and it never had been studied even until fairly recently. And so I named it with some colleagues about 5 or 6 years ago, and we call it motivation wave. So your motivation will go up, but then it will come down. And this is motivation for a particular thing, like my motivation to exercise, really high at the first of the year, and it goes up and then it starts fading. And maybe your motivation to learn French, you have a trip to France coming up. So you're motivated to learn French. And then after you get home from your trip, it goes down. So these waves happen all the time, and it hadn't been named. I do like motivation wave as a construct. The research on it really is very limited, and only there's bits, tiny bits and pieces, but only about 2007 were there a few papers that came out. And even now, there's not a lot of literature on this. So it's really odd that there's something that's so common to human experience. One, had never been named. And two, there's just not a lot of research on it. And there's reasons for that. I mean, the way academic work moves forward, especially in the social sciences, it's political. It's driven by lots of things. But this is a big gap. And so certainly there hadn't been the insight that motivation and ability are like these teammates and companions, and that motivation is going to go up and down and you can't really have tons of control over that. So then you have to focus on ability. And that's what the behavior model really made clear to me was, wow, you have this relationship. Motivation is this slippery thing. You can't really control that well, maybe for a limited time, but not in the long term. But ability is something you can control and you can design for. So that's why it's called tiny habits and not like exciting habits or motivational habits. Yeah, we can make things really tiny. That's what we can design for very reliably.
Got it. This is your host, Deepak Jayaraman here. I'm reminded of something that came up in my conversation with Rich Fernandez, CEO of Search Inside Yourself, a leadership development organization incubated in Google. He speaks about how we think about weaving in mindfulness in the smallest of things we do, rather than making it a big Herculean task, which is one more thing that we need to do in addition to everything else that's going on in our lives. Something that's relevant as we are packing in several things into our lives in these times.
The other suggestion I have is something we offer in our curriculum, which is make it a set of integrated practices. When people think about meditation, they think about having to do exactly what I just said, which is set aside, X block of time and, sit in a certain way and close your eyes and protect this space for formal practice. But there's also a way to practice mindfulness and meditation in an integrated way. So, for example, as you move through the course of your day, integrate it into your day. Between meetings, if you need to walk to the restroom, make that a walking meditation. I'm actually serious about that, right? Become aware of your body as it moves through space between your office and the restroom. Become aware of your footfall. Become aware of, you know, the felt sense of your body. How are you feeling actually in that moment? Or take the opportunity to focus on breath, or this being in India, this podcast, you know, if you have a mantra that you're, you know, that you're familiar with or particularly like, use that. And I say mantra, and there's often a religious component to that. But here, what I'm referring to is really finding an object of your attention to train your attention upon it, whether it be mantra or breath or walking or sensation. You can really do this throughout the course of your day. I was driving to work today and I was focusing on my breath, not so much so that I wasn't able to drive, but when there was a red light, when I was stopped in traffic, in and out for three breaths, I noticed my breath. Next stoplight, same thing. Integrated practice is also a helpful one.
Back to what BJ says, keeping the habit tiny and weaving it into some of the other things we do might help us overcome the vagaries of motivation that we grapple with as we go through our lives. Now, let's get back to the conversation with BJ Fogg.
And moving to motivation, you talk about the distinction between motivation and aspiration. I found that I found that nuance quite interesting. And but you also say our motivation, the complexity of our motivation, results in a psychological tug of war, and that can be a tough element to handle. Could you talk about these two elements when it comes to motivation?
Yeah. Another challenge with the whole domain of behavior change and psychology a little bit more broadly, but I'm focused on behavior and behavior change, is our vocabulary. And we don't have adequate words for things. And so I've had to come up with words for some things like motivation wave, for example. And then when it comes to, something like how motivation works, we have things that motivate us and we have things that demotivate us. So for any given behavior, let's say eating broccoli tonight at dinner, that specific behavior, there might be things that motivate me like, oh, I'm hoping it will be really good for me. But then there might be something that demotivates me like, oh, I'm afraid I'm going to cut myself, or I hate cleaning the broccoli or whatever. So you have these, it's like vectors. So you can think of any level of motivation for anything as you have things that are motivating you to do it and things that are demotivating you to do it, like vectors in physics, and they push on each other. Mm-hmm. And there are two ways to change the overall level of motivation. You can either try to boost, like broccoli's so good for you, it's so healthy, it's so great, so you can push up, or you can remove what's demotivating you. Let's say you hate washing the broccoli, but then you find you can wear gloves, so you don't get your hands like wet or soapy. So now that demotivator of, yeah, I don't like the soap, I don't like the washing, well, you wear gloves, so that goes away. So one of the key ways, if you need to increase your motivation for something, is to look at what's demotivating it and try to remove that demotivator. And often it's fear that is the thing that's demotivating you to go to the gym or to try a new recipe or to give a talk at a business conference and so on.
Got it. Just moving to the other piece, celebration, BJ. You talk about celebration being a habit fertilizer. You spoke about it earlier in our conversation. But I like the nuance you bring between the distinction between celebration and rewards.
And so
you talk about, and you talk about the fact that the brain requires a quick lock-in after a behavior. Could you talk a little bit more about the distinction here?
Yeah, so rewards is one of those words that the way we use it in English today is ambiguous. And reward is the right technical term. However, many people use it in a way that's not accurate. Too often when people say, oh, I'm going to go to the gym and then I'm going to reward myself by, you know, going and watching a movie. Well, I would call that a prize or an incentive. It's not a reward. Reward is the thing that happens as you do the behavior or immediately after. And your brain associates the reward with the habit you just did. And so because it's a problematic word, I've decided not to use that word. Again, it's ambiguous. And if you have an ambiguous word, then it's not a very good technical term. So instead, I talk about celebration as a technique for creating a positive emotion. So it's serving the function of a reward in the technical sense of things. But I try not to use that word because too often people think of a reward as like a prize they'll get at the end of 30 days. So I'll, you know, eat a vegetable every day and at the end of 30 days, I'll get my reward. Well, that doesn't wire in the habit. That's serving as an incentive to motivate you, but it doesn't serve to wire in the habit. So really what you're shooting for to wire in the habit is to cause a positive emotion inside yourself. Now, sometimes these will happen naturally. When you look at any app or technology that you love and you use on a daily basis, I would wager a lot of money that the first time you use that app or that technology, it made you feel very successful. It made you feel like you had superpowers, like, oh my gosh, I can do so much. I'm so capable with this. And that's what helped wire that in as a habit, was that sense of success. I'm achieving something important. And so that will happen naturally with, oh, lots of things. But for new habits, that doesn't always happen naturally. The fact that you're wiping the kitchen counter doesn't make you go, oh, I'm so great, you know, naturally. So you hack that emotion by going, look at the counter, I'm so awesome. You know, so you deliberately cause that emotion to fire off. And so celebration is the term that we decided to use for causing that emotion. And we looked at other terms like self-cheer. That was one we looked at, or just plain cheer, you know, cheer yourself, cheer for yourself. I could have also picked like reinforce, self-reinforcement as the word, but self-reinforcement has already been used in the 70s to mean something, and it's something quite a bit different. So I couldn't use the term self-reinforcement, but that's what you're doing with celebration. You're reinforcing, you're making that habit stronger, and you're doing it deliberately. So celebration is the technique to self-reinforce.
Got it. And talking about growing habits, when is a point where we can start thinking about moving from a tiny habit to a big change? How long should we keep it tiny? What does your research show?
Well, the surprising answer is you can do it day one. You can do a bigger version of the habit anytime that you want. But the key with tiny habits is you set the bar low and you keep it low. You can always go way over the bar if you want and say, count it as extra credit, but you don't have to. For the years I've been flossing two times a day, there are some days I just floss one tooth and I move on. And I do not consider that a failure. I consider it a big success. It's like, oh, something was going on. Maybe I was really distracted or busy or just not in the mood. I still got the habit done. Good for me. So the idea in tiny habits is not start tiny and then raise the bar. It's not that. Just too many journalists and people writing about tiny habits. And that's not how it's done. You set the bar low and you keep it low. But you will find that you will naturally do more and more. But you don't raise the bar even so. You just keep thinking of yourself as a superstar, as the A-plus student who is overachieving continually. And that takes a mindset shift, especially for high achievers who are used to raise the bar and you just keep going higher and higher. And so it really is a skill. This is one of the skills I talk about in the book, is to set the bar low and keep it low and actually be good with underachieving and being okay on those days you can just floss one tooth, being okay with that and not feeling bad, but feeling positive. That reaction is a skill. And so for the high achievers out there listening, this concept may surprise you, but this is how you make habits. Aren't really about the size of the habit. It's about the consistency of the habit. And as long as you're being consistent, you can do a bigger version anytime. So you really, really want to get the consistency nailed. Do more when you want to, and when you don't want to or can't, just do the tiny version and keep it consistent.
Got it. This is your host, Deepak Jayaraman here. This is a profound point that BJ makes. A lot of people, I would include myself here, often fall victim to the habit and become its slaves without realizing. Devdutt Patnaik makes the point
in quite a provocative but an effective way.
See, this concept of habits is a Western idea. It comes Indian, you see, habit is a bad word in Indian philosophy. It's a bad word. Therefore, you're continuously, another word for habit is conditioned. I'm conditioned to do it. Conditioning, that's a Pavlovian response, right? A dog has a habit of salivating whenever the bell rings. And the West has made it a virtue. Action without thought is habit. Repetitive action without thought is habit. And if you look at the many of the cultures in the West, they are like domesticated animals. At a particular time, they'll get up and run. At a particular time, they'll get up. So there is, it's this kind of a, they are on a treadmill all the time. And this is seen as virtue. You know, driving in the car with a coffee in your hand. Nobody sees in America that this is tragedy. It's a tragedy. You can't enjoy your coffee. You can't enjoy your drive. You have glamorized slavery. You have glamorized slavery. And nobody sees it because you are all the Gurujis in their white coats with their chin, what is that called, the fist on the chin photographs, you know, those photographs that you see, are telling you, therefore it must be right. Nobody's questioning, what is the habit? And habit has been somehow projected as a good thing. Indian thought is all about awareness. It's all about awareness. Why are you doing what you're doing? Why are you doing what you're doing? Why are you not doing what you're not doing? And once you're aware, then you realize what is of value to you and what is not of value to you. So you are not in a habit, then breaking habits becomes difficult. And then breaking habit becomes, there are good habits, there are bad habits. Habits are good and bad depending on context. You know, so you will find people behaving, that's why I always find, you know, when expats come to India, they have a tough time because the habit is suddenly in this new context, they don't know. Because, oh my God, there is no place to run. There is no place to, oh my God, they don't have this thing. Because the habit, right, they become the animal. You have become like an animal. And habit really goes to the lower part of your brain, not the upper part of your brain. And your habit is about avoiding life. You do habits like, it's an addiction.
It's like autopilot.
It's an autopilot. No, and it's addictive. Like, I have a habit of writing, but it's addiction. If I don't write, I get withdrawal symptoms, which means I've trained my body to be in pain when I don't do it and to get pleasure when I do it. And I'm not aware of it. I'm just doing it mechanically. So we are an awareness culture. Awareness, 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 not habit culture. Habit culture, empathy goes away.
Devdutt speaks about the role of awareness versus habits and how we should not become slave to the habit. That still leaves us figuring out how we build good habits while being aware. Instead of seeing this as either or, is there a way we can combine the two and get the benefits from it? Here's where we turn to the Japanese for inspiration. One of my earlier guests, James Clear, author of the book Atomic Habits, speaks about something that he observed in Japanese train stations.
There's this method, which is called pointing and calling, that I think helps raise our level of awareness about our current habits. And once we become aware of our habits, then we can change them. Then we can start to more meaningfully adjust them. So the story, and I actually saw this when I went to Tokyo. If you walk around Tokyo and go to a train station, what you'll see is this interesting pattern where when the train pulls into the station, the conductor will point at like a signal and say the signal is green, or they'll point at the speedometer and say a speedometer is 30 kilometers an hour. Outside on the platform, other employees are doing similar things. They're pointing up and down the platform and they'll say platform is clear. The cleaning staff, even as they walk onto the train in between sessions to clean it off, take the trash out and so on, they'll point at each car and, you know, say car is clean or trash is clear, things like that. And the purpose of this is that for anybody who does the same kind of job over and over again, like a train conductor pulling into the station, it becomes kind of automatic that, you know, it becomes habitual. And so it's very easy to overlook your mistakes. And so by pointing and calling, by literally physically pointing and saying out loud what you're doing, you're raising the level of awareness of the action. And you people don't use the phrase pointing and calling, but you can see them do this kind of thing all the time in daily life. So for example, I have a friend who, she'll leave the garage door up accidentally sometimes. And so now every time she pulls out of her garage, she points at the door and says, garage door is down. or when you're getting ready to go on a trip or leave your house for a few days, you might double check everything and say, I have my keys, I have my glasses, I have my wallet. And you're like touching them in your pockets while you're doing that. And so those are all examples of pointing and calling to try to double check, to raise the awareness, to be aware, more aware of what we're doing. And if you want, you can actually use that same strategy when you're trying to build or break habits. So for example, if you want to stop snacking, when you reach into the cupboard to get out a cookie or go to the pantry to get out a snack, you could say, I'm about to eat this cookie and I don't want to because I'm trying to stop snacking. And just the act of saying that out loud before you do it might be enough to prevent you from it. It sounds silly. It sounds a little like over the top to do it. But it can be a very useful strategy early on so that you become more aware of your behavior.
I guess the long and short of the point I want to make here is that while we often glorify building habits, we forget the criticality of building awareness. Like BJ says, being aware gives us the ability to ramp up or ramp down a habit, depending on the circumstances, without being obsessed by it. Habit is a bit like the engine of an automobile, where awareness is like the steering wheel, without which you could end up crashing your Formula One car when you see a bend in the road. You would appreciate the significant effort that goes in editing each of these conversations, where we also try and connect the dots with some of the other nuggets from other guests in the podcast. Hope you find that valuable and helpful. My only request is that if you find the podcast of value, that you take a moment and rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or any other platform where you consume the content. It will help other listeners discover this podcast and benefit from it. Given the extent of clutter in the world of content creation, this one simple action from you will help people sift signal from the noise and help more people benefit from the content. Now, let's get back to the conversation with BJ Fogg.
And moving to maybe breaking free from bad habits, you also use the back to also being specific about language. You mentioned that breaking a habit is possibly not the right language and untangling it is more like it. What's the nuance the way you see it, BJ?
I am so glad you're asking all these questions about terminology. Maybe I'll just do an academic paper just on this. The language around behavior change has held us back. And this word, break bad habits, has been one of the problems. Because break implies that if you put a lot of force in at one moment, like breaking a stick, it'll be done. So a lot of force, a lot of energy in one moment is how you solve it. That's not how these kinds of habits get solved. It's not about a one-time thing that gets people to stop gambling or stop drinking or stop gaming or whatever the addiction is or whatever the bad habit is. So I am proposing and explaining how a better word is untangle unwanted habits. And that then implies a process. Just like if you think of your phone headset all tangled up, wow, it looks overwhelming. You're not going to solve it just by yanking on it in one moment. But you know that if you take the easiest tangle, not the hardest, and undo that, and then go to the next easiest one, that you'll get there. Same thing with these things that we call bad habits. They tend to be things, snacking is a pretty easy example to use. So if you have you consider a bad habit of, you know, eating bad foods as a snack, it's not just one thing. It's probably there's a snack in the morning, there's a snack at lunch, snack driving home, snack in the evening, snack at 3 a.m. So it's a tangle that we call a habit, but really it's all these habits connected together. And so you take the easiest snacking habit to stop, the easiest one, not the hardest one, and you design that out of your life. And then you go to the next one and the next one. And so I think untangling really sets the expectation much better that it's a process and really maps very well to how you look at a tangled rope or a phone headset. At first, it's overwhelming and you're like, oh my gosh. But then as you get started, you see it starts resolving and then pretty soon it comes completely clear. It untangles. And so I think that's right on for how many of these unwanted habits work.
And talking about phones, BJ, maybe to pick another use case, given the digital distraction that we face, given the phones we have, Any commentary around how we can begin to entangle, untangle?
How long do we have? Deepak. You know, at Stanford, you know, Stanford's a wonderful institution, and at least for me, a very flexible one. So I get to teach as much as I want or as little as I want and so on. So I've chosen to teach once a year, and I can teach anything pretty much. So every year I come up with a new course, and it always has to do with behavior change. So I always look at what's the most important thing we could be doing. Well, this year it's behavior design for coronavirus challenges. That's what we're doing right now in my class at Stanford. That's the most important thing we could be doing. It was going to be behavior design for climate action, because it's like, oh my gosh, this climate, let's, but with the coronavirus thing, then it was like, no, this is more urgent. So that'll be later, the climate action. But last year, the focus was on screen time. So let's use what we know about behavior design to help people reduce screen time or have a healthier relationship with technology. And so we did a lot of work there. And there's, it's a problem that has lots of facets to it. It's like who's doing what and so on. And we have a tool that anyone can use at screentime.stanford.edu that can connect you to our database of over 150 different ways to reduce screen time. You answer a few questions to this genie character, and then the genie, you know, has some AI and then says, here are the three solutions you should try. But let me give some really simple, yes, you can go to Screen Time Genie and do that, but some simple examples. For example, before I started talking to you, so I have this habit. It's very simple. I just turn my watch over. I scroll up. I push on the little moon sign. And I go on, I don't even know what it's called. I know how to do it. It's called Do Not Disturb. So I do that for 1 hour. Simple, simple, simple. And it means I'm not checking my phone and I'm not being interrupted while I'm talking to you. So you can just create these habits of going on Do Not Disturb. Maybe it's a habit of turning off the internet router at night. So after I lock the door, I will turn off the internet router. Maybe it's not a habit, but a policy of, hey, everybody at our family dinner table, no mobile phones allowed. I know in my own life at parties that I host, I don't let people use their phones. It's like, you've come to my party, your phone, you're not using it. And same thing with dinners that I'm hosting. It's like, no, you're not going to be on your phone at my dinner because I'm paying for it and I'm hosting you. And that means you're going to be present. So sometimes it's habits that you can form. Other times, and I think we're going to go here as a culture and even more globally, is to understand there's etiquette around these things. And if you're at somebody's dinner, at somebody's party, you do not pull out your phone and disconnect. Last year, I was in charge of my family reunion. And as a Mormon family, it's a big family. And we get together once a year on an island in Idaho. So we have a cabin on this island. And I was in charge. The leadership rotates among the siblings. So every 6 years, I'm in charge. And I thought, well, what theme? We always have a theme. It could be Olympics. It could be cowboys. It could be pioneers. I thought, well, the theme is going to be airplane mode. This reunion's all about not using our screens, but instead actually being present with each other. Because what typically happens, and it drove me crazy, is we would come from all over the place, this little island, and then people would be texting their friends in Las Vegas or wherever they're from. So I thought I'd have a big rebellion on my hands with my family, but they loved it. They loved it. So we had very specific rules set up about how you could use your devices and how you can't use them. And it really led to a wonderful reunion where we were there and we just really talked more. We played more games. People were 100% present. And so I do think that's coming, that we will get out of our awkward, adolescent, inappropriate use of technologies, both when we're alone and with others. And we will have a more mature approach, an etiquette around it, and we'll understand that you simply don't sit at a restaurant, at a business dinner or a party and pull out your phone and check messages. That would be like farting at the table, or that would be like pulling out cigarettes and starting smoking in somebody's home. You just don't do it. So I think we will get there.
Got it. And maybe that's a good segue to talking about what's front and center in our lives, COVID-19.
Mm-hmm.
You spoke about, teaching a course at Stanford on this topic. Maybe if we look at it from the lens of building habits, new habits, as we sort of grapple with the emerging new normal, any themes that you see emerging, BJ, any common questions that people come to you with as we are sort of grappling this current situation?
Yes. And we seem to be shifting through things. So early on, it was, how do we stop touching our face and how do we wash our hands? Okay, that was early. There's less around that now because most people are sheltering in place. And so then next it's, oh my gosh, how do I be productive during lockdown? Or how do I get along with my spouse and kids? Or how do I homeschool my kids? And so at this point, in fact, just today in my class, so now they're going into their third project around this. And the third project is about a global intervention. How do you solve a problem related to coronavirus that something that could go global? And so what we did today was we mapped out the top behavior challenges related to coronavirus. And so rather than the students just picking something random, as you know, I'm all into systems. So let's not just pick some random problem. We are then systematizing what are the top problems. So we did it on an individual level, a class level, and tomorrow we push it out basically to crowdsource and have other people chime in and upvote and downvote the different challenges. And then the students will pick one of the top 10 challenges and design a solution or an intervention for that. One of the things that surprised me today, just from the class, like students putting stuff into this system where you upvote and downvote, and we looked at the result just for the class, was the one that struck me. And I had all the students like pick the one that emotionally just catches you and that moves you. And for me, it was grieving during this period. And I kind of thought about it, but not really. And I thought, you know what? That is a really big challenge and people need guidance. And we can use behavior design to help people deal with grief or grieve effectively during this period. And of course, some of the other top challenges were like income and not transmitting disease and not catching disease and small business owners who no longer have revenue and those kinds of things. And I really want the students, after we get more global input, and we're not looking for thousands, we're looking for a few hundred people to basically share their views. So we have a top 10 list. And then I really want the students then in about 3 days from now, we'll look at that list and pick a challenge to address and solve. And they have 4 weeks to create something, get it out there, measure the impact. And that will be the final project. And all those projects will be public.
Got it. And just as we wrap up, BJ, I'm curious about this gap between knowing something and doing something, right? Mm-hmm. And your work, one could read a book, but in your experience over the years dealing with tiny habits, where do you see the maximum gap between knowing and doing in the people you work with, where they get it cognitively but struggle to incorporate it behaviorally? And any piece of advice for the listeners
Yes. On
ensuring that these don't stay as thoughts, but we are able to translate that to new habits?
Yeah, so I don't have data on where the biggest issue is here, but I have coached over 40,000 people in habits personally. So mm-hmm. I have a ton of experience. I have more experience coaching personally than anybody, I think. I can't imagine anybody. I've really done more like 50 or 60,000. I just stopped counting at 40,000. So to answer your question, my sense of things is the biggest gap is with smart people. People who like to read, people who like to get information, people who in the past have succeeded because you've consumed information and remembered information. And my Stanford students are a lot like this. And they're often afraid to put things into action because they're afraid of failing, because they're used to succeeding. So they will procrastinate, they will delay, they will find all these reasons that they're not going to get started on changing or started on writing a paper or whatever. For those two reasons. One, they're very good at consuming information and remembering it. And two, they like to succeed. So if something might cause them not to succeed, they either deliberately or not really realizing it will procrastinate it. So in response to that, it's funny you'd ask this question. It was last night. I don't tweet that much, but every so often I just like, somebody calls me or I'm answering an email or I'm helping somebody create habits. I was like, people need to know this. So I tweeted something like this. The key, well, I wrote it, for the vast majority of people, the key to unlock behavior change is not increasing motivation. Instead, it's lowering your expectations and just getting started. And be nice to yourself all along the way. And Twitter went a little, at least my followers went a little crazy over that. They loved it. I wasn't sure what was going to happen. But so many people. So I woke up this morning and I looked at some of the comments and there are people like, I'm screenshotting this. I'm printing it. I'm putting it over my computer. This is exactly what I needed to hear right now. So I totally hit a nerve where I'm telling people, like I do in the book, Tiny Habits, if you've tried to change in the past and it hasn't worked, this is not your fault. You just didn't have the right way to do it. Now here's the right way. And so for people to have the relief of like, here's a behavior scientist at Stanford telling me, lower my expectations and don't feel bad about the motivation thing, that just helps so many people get, and then notice it's not just lower your expectations, but it's lower your expectations and just get started. Like do it now. And then really important, be nice to yourself along the way. Don't beat yourself up. Don't shame and guilt and feeling bad. It has no role in the Tiny Habits method. And it's not the best way to change in the long term. And that is such a new, almost, well, for some people shocking, but for most people surprising insight that they react like that on Twitter, or they're like, oh my gosh, that's what I need. I'm printing it. There was a lot of retweets and a lot of likes and all that kind of stuff. And that's how I kind of know, like, okay, I've hit a nerve and this is really what my book's about. And I'd love to say, yeah, buy my book, people, you would have known this, but that's not what I'm going to say on Twitter. It's you got so many characters and I try to be as helpful as possible within that framework.
Got it. BJ, this is lovely. Maybe it's a good, that's a great note for us to end this conversation. Thank you so much for making the time.
Deepak, thank you. And such great questions. And I'm so happy to, well, thank you for helping me share Tiny Habits and this work with more people. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely.
I hope that you found the conversation purposeful. I really liked the point BJ makes as we were wrapping up the conversation. The notion of smart people struggling to incubate new habits. Something like this shows up all the time in the work I do as well. In the coaching and the transition advisory work I do, I encounter several people who've had a good first 15 to 20 year run in whichever field they've worked in. But as they take stock of where they are and the choices they need to make, I urge them to start experimenting and trying different things, but they really struggle. And that's because the past successes come in the way of them taking risks. The previous guest of the podcast, Jennifer Garvey Berger, spoke about the five traps we often find ourselves in, and one of the five traps she talks about is being shackled by the past, which in a sense is very similar to the point BJ makes here. One of my earlier guests, Raj Raghunathan, has written the book, If You're So Smart, Why Aren't You Happy?, which touches upon a similar theme. As Marshall Goldsmith says, what got you here doesn't get you there. But the sad reality I notice is that several successful people get somewhere by the time they are 40 and then land up in a funny place. They can't climb the first mountain anymore because the air has gotten thinner and it's taking a toll on the rest of their life. And given the risk aversion that BJ speaks about, they struggle to walk around figuring out the foothills of the next mountain that they could climb. If this is of interest, you might like to listen to the nugget Keep Your Identity Small by James Clear, the author of Atomic Habits, or the nugget Trap 5, Shackled by the Past by Jennifer Garvey Berger. Thank you for listening. As you know, quite a bit of work goes into researching, producing, and publishing a conversation. We also try and connect the dots across the various conversations as much as we can. Hope you find that of value. If you're deriving value from the podcast, I would request two things for you to consider. First, do rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or whichever platform you consume this podcast. Given the tsunami of content out there, it will really help other listeners discover this podcast and seek value from it. A small action by you could make a big difference to someone else. Second, do consider paying it forward to Antarang Foundation, a not-for-profit that I work with closely. They work with children from less privileged backgrounds, and they help them play to their potential by imparting life skills, giving them career guidance, and connecting them to the world of formal employment. We're all seeing what's happening around the world due to economic inequity. No easy answers, but the one piece we need to solve as a society is to ensure that the young adults are productively engaged in a vocation that they are passionate about. Antarang Foundation is all about making that happen. Thank you, and look forward to having you at a subsequent conversation on the podcast. For more, do check out the podcast archives, which include curated playlists by theme, 500 plus nuggets, and 56 plus guests at playtopotential.com. To know more about the coaching and the advisory work I do, please visit About the Host section at playtopotential.com. Bye now.